Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Good hospice care may well be some of the kindest, wisest medicine there is. Knowing what to do and not to do, easing pain and fear, helping when the time comes to reach a peaceful death. But what was once run mostly as a charity is increasingly a big for-profit business. Too often, says a big new investigation, a business touched with fraud. Medicare, you the taxpayer, has been footing the bill. Just since the year 2000, the national tab has grown more than five times over. This hour On Point, for-profit hospice care under scrutiny. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you watched a loved one as they died under the care of hospice workers? What did you see? The kindest care? A cold business? Would you know how to choose between the best and the worst hospice care for yourself or someone in your family? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from San Francisco is Ben Hallman. He is senior financial reporter and investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. His tough, big new story on American hospice care is headlined "How Dying Became a Multi-Billion Dollar Industry." You can find a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Ben Hallman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How did hospice care turn from nonprofit to profit anyway, Ben?
Well, it began with the advent of the Medicare hospice benefit back in the early 80s. And this was a move by Congress to, put Medicare dollars into hospice with the recognition that this was a growing health field and that it could potentially lead to savings for taxpayers because the cost of providing care at home to someone at the end of their life is potentially less than providing senseless or, sometimes even painful treatment in a hospital. So, as you pointed out at the top of the show, in the last decade, it's really exploded. And what was once, the province of mostly religious-affiliated nonprofits is now overwhelmingly a large business.
I think most Americans, even now, have a pretty good impression of the hospice as a place of mercy, a knowing place of calm, departure, death when that time finally comes. Overall, they seem to me to have a pretty good reputation, but you're describing all kinds of suits being here brought by the federal government trying to get a handle on what, Ben? What's going on?
Well, so the allegations and the cases really started ramping up, about a decade ago. And again, they sort of track with the evolution of hospice from a nonprofit to a for-profit business. The lawsuits and counted more than a dozen federal cases brought over that time, alleged that hospices are signing up patients who don't belong on hospice, who, aren't sick and dying as Medicare requires. And not discharging patients even when they get better. And then in some instances, bumping patients up to more expensive, for Medicare forms of treatment, such as this continuous around-the-clock care, which is about four times the cost of, your routine standard at-home hospice care.
In what you call the most watched federal lawsuit, and there are plenty, as you say, but this one was filed last May accusing a company called Vitas, in pretty strong language, of harming patients in the pursuit of profits. And this is a suit based on allegations brought by former employees of this particular hospice chain, employees in Texas and California and Illinois, contending the company, and quoting here, focused on maximizing Medicare reimbursement for as many patients as possible while disregarding patients' medical needs. We've seen Medicare spending on hospice go from $2.9 billion in the year 2000 to more than $15 billion last year. Your suggestion is that a lot of that is growing on over-aggressive, inflated, kind of out-of-control hospice business practices.
Well, I think there's potentially two reasons why the spending has increased. One is simply this movement from hospice, from a sort of a niche healthcare idea into the mainstream. Part of the reason for that movement is the success that for-profit and nonprofit companies have had in marketing hospice and convincing doctors and nurses that this is indeed the best, most humane way to tend to people who are in the last stages of life.
And it may well be, but the dollar numbers have gone way up. The spending per person has gone way up. The length of time in hospice has nearly doubled, which is kind of hard to understand. For-profit hospice care running almost a third higher, 29% higher in expense than not-for-profit. What are the key findings of your big report, Ben?
Well, that's one of them. The for-profit companies, patients tend to stay on the service for longer. And this goes, almost regardless of what the disease or the terminal illness that they're suffering from is, this sort of holds true. The for-profit companies, as a group, tend to, the patients, they bill higher rates per patient. The average stay per patient is longer, and patients are discharged less often. So Medicare requires that, because Medicare pays 90% of all hospice bills, sort of what Medicare says goes in a lot of instances in terms of how this treatment is supposed to work. And Medicare's requirement is that hospice patients, to be certified as Medicare appropriate, have 6 months or less to live. And this is obviously that's to some degree, a difficult determination to make. However, once again, the for-profit companies seem to be enrolling patients that are less sick and maybe less needing of this, very specific form of treatment or care than the nonprofit players.
I mean, you've got salespeople essentially for hospice companies describing how they would cruise a nursing home or hospital hallways looking for people to get into their hospice. You quote one here, James Robbins from Acera Care Hospice. This is a chain in 19 states saying it's not even about patient care anymore. They've gone to the dark side. It's all about the money. You've got, since in the last half dozen years or 8 years, U.S. government accused nearly every major for-profit hospice company of billing fraud. Hospice is billing by the day, and there's for-profit stays much significantly longer than nonprofits. 2009, Medicare charges 29% higher on the for-profit than for the nonprofits. And right on down the list, what does it mean in terms of day in and day out in hospice or in hospice care, which could be at home? How can it be that the time people stay there is double what it was in the year 2000? If people are going in terminally ill, looking at death, why has it gone from 44 to 88 days? It's hard to understand.
Well, one of the reasons is the expansion of hospice into treating or caring for patients with different forms of illnesses. So, in the early days, hospice was mostly for cancer patients, and determining the end of life for a cancer patient is typically considered a little bit easier than maybe someone with Alzheimer's, for example. However, that change does not explain the length of stay. So one of our findings was that even for patients with diseases where the end of life may be more difficult to predict, like Alzheimer's, the patient stays have increased dramatically.
You take the story of Vitas, one of these big chains, all the way back to a Methodist minister who started as a nonprofit way back in the 80s or earlier. Hospice was kind of a new idea then. It had come over from London. This is Hugh Westbrook, a Methodist minister who recognized that there could be big profits here as Medicare moved in. He went to a for-profit basis. At this point, it's a very big company owned by a parent company, ChemMed, the same parent company that that owns the plumbing chain Roto-Rooter, a very big player now in hospice care. What kind of charges is Vitas looking at? Allegations.
Well, Well, you know, you mentioned the federal lawsuit, and I was struck by the language in the lawsuit, which, you know, alleges that the abuses detailed by prosecutors were not just past tense, but are ongoing. You know, this is as of last May when the lawsuit was filed. They're ongoing and with the knowledge of ChemEd and VITAS executives. So the specific allegation is that the company is enrolling people who don't need the service into what's called continuous care or crisis care. And this is, sometimes called round-the-clock care. So this is essentially the idea is you have a hospice nurse at your bedside all the time. And in some instances, this is very appropriate. If someone is experiencing a severe pain crisis or needs a medical professional, this can be a real boon. But what the government alleges is that VITAS uses this way too much. I think their billings are six times the national average, according to the lawsuit. And my investigation, I talked to dozens of VITAS nurses and doctors in Florida and Texas and in Pennsylvania. And, they essentially describe exactly the same thing, that they were being pressured to enroll people in this elevated, more expensive form of care, that they were discouraged from discharging patients who might be getting better who didn't qualify in the first place.
Routine care, $146 a day in hospice. Continuous care, $853 a day. Bump a patient up there and the revenues go way up. The cost has gone way up since the year 2000, from $2.9 billion to $15.1 billion in this country. Lots of suits. Ben Hallman is reporting on them for Huffington Post. His big new piece, How Dying Became a Multi-Billion Dollar Industry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about hospice care in America now, often for profit, big business, and some say bad business for the dying and for taxpayers. I'm joined by Ben Hallman. He's senior financial reporter and investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. His big piece is How Dying Became a Multi-Billion Dollar Industry. You can join us this hour. Do you know the hospice world, the hospice business? Have you watched a loved one go through it? How was it? Hospital workers, have you seen hospice reps trolling for business? Hospice workers, have you seen it done right, done wrong? We'll hear in a moment from the president of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. They have for-profit and nonprofit members. Ben Hallman, I have to say, looking at response online here from lots of our listeners all over the country, and overwhelmingly, it's positive. You know, my son died of cancer in hospice care. It was excellent care. I'm reading here, godsend. I'm reading here, it was great, a glimpse of heaven. It was incredible. Couldn't do without it. Wonderful, indispensable. When you ask people about hospice experience, at least from this small sample, we've got an outpouring of gratitude, Ben.
I think that is in fact the case. I think that this is an extremely emotional and difficult time in people's lives. I think most hospice workers are dedicated professionals. They're dealing with have to work in very fraught environments and navigating the emotional complexity of families who are dealing with a trauma. And I think the good news is that it remains the case that for most families, the experience is a good one, and that hospice remains the best alternative to, spending one's final days in a hospital or, undergoing some unnecessary painful treatment outside of the home. One of the really, I think, nice things about hospice is that in most instances, or in many instances at least, it's an at-home service, so people can die, surrounded by their family.
But your great big piece is extremely critical. I mean, I have to say, you read this and you wonder what you're getting into when you go to hospice. This manipulative kind of approach to maximize profit, maximize Medicare payout, and putting the patient last. And you're not the only one reporting this. I'm looking here at a Washington Post piece from just last month, Terminal Neglect, How Some Hospices Treat Dying Patients.
Well, that's right, and I think one thing that is lacking is a greater understanding of exactly what's going on a case by case basis, and as we point out in our investigation, hospices simply aren't regulated in the same way that, you know, hospitals or nursing homes are. So, for example, nursing homes are required under federal law to be inspected every 15 months. There is no federal requirement for hospice inspections. We found that the average is about 3.5 years. We found, I think, more than 700 hospices haven't been inspected in more than 6 years. So, you know, part of the issue is we don't have a lot of information. Starting next January, I believe, the Medicare's regulator will begin surveying some hospice patients. And though that data is not supposed to be made available for a long time, at least there is some effort to you know, quiz families, ask them about what happened, what their experience was like, and then maybe single out providers that aren't doing a good job.
It's kind of incredible to read these stories, but then right up alongside it, the gratitude of many families who have found some peace for loved ones there. Let me begin to hear our callers, and we'll also go to the National Hospice Organization in just a moment. Augusta, Georgia, Ipanema is calling. Ipanema, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
Well, when I was 22, my father-in-law was diagnosed late stage with terminal cancer, and it came to a point where we were all sitting in that little room in the hospital, and the doctor basically told us, this is the end of the line. He can either pass away here in the hospital under some unnecessary procedure that could cause him more pain, or you all can take him home where he can die peacefully. And when you get old like me, you want to die at home. So we made the decision to bring him home, and just like that, they were trolling the halls. Hospice care workers were in our little room telling us why they were the best and how they did better in the community than everybody else. And, I mean, hospice for us was overall a great experience. He did get to die peacefully at home, but I would just like people to know that the nurse is not going to be with you 24 hours a day. There is no doctor. We experienced no bedside care. If we had an issue, we had to call the 24-hour hotline, and maybe a nurse would come out with us. We were administering him morphine. We were administering him these high levels of painkillers as non-professional medical workers. I was just his daughter-in-law. So it's a double-edged sword. Hospice was great that he got to die peacefully, but also I would say it was a great burden on our family, which eventually led to the demise of my marriage, watching all that go on and just having all this pressure on all of us all the time to be these great workers, these great caregivers, and we weren't certified for that.
Ipanema, you give us the bright and the dark of it, and I really appreciate that story. Ben Hellman, respond to that. First, they sent up the signal they were ready to go, and immediately the sort of sales reps were on them from hospice land. Is that typical?
It may be. I mean, in many hospitals, hospice workers, in some instances, are literally trolling the hallways looking for patients. What most of the time, what happens is that a hospice marketer will, you know, make friends with or get in the good graces of a discharged person at a hospital. And the caller saw happens a little bit more behind the scenes, and so whatever scrambling happens, is not necessarily in front of the patient. But in terms of what she was saying about being left in some instances to administer medicine and whatnot, that is essentially how hospice works in most cases. Nurses come by once or twice a week. Perhaps a home health aide will come by to bathe the patient or provide some personal care, but families are left alone to administer these drugs, and that can cause issues, and it can be a real pressure cooker environment.
You write about manipulative, profit seeking treatment of patients in a hospice setting. Like what, Ben?
Say that question again.
You're writing here about for-profit hospice companies manipulating their treatment of patients to maximize their profit, and I'm asking you to tell our listeners what you're reporting.
Indeed. Again, this goes back to figuring out ways to keep patients on the service for as long as possible, or signing up people who don't belong or are perhaps not fully informed about the service. So hospice is a very specific type of healthcare. It is palliative in nature. It does not provide life-saving treatments. For the most part, that means that patients are given morphine or some other strong drugs to help ease their suffering. And in many instances, that's very much the the appropriate course of care. But if patients aren't completely on board with this idea, and if families aren't completely on board with this idea, it can lead to turmoil and dissent within the family. And one of the family that I profile in the story is just such a case. The grandmother in the family was enrolled. The family clearly did not really understand the intent and purpose of hospice, and then they had a bad experience as a result.
Let's go to Robert in Appleton, Wisconsin. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to say I'm a medical oncologist, and I think it's fantastic that you're bringing this issue up to the public, because I can tell you where I practice, there are, besides two nonprofits, there are five for-profit hospice organizations, and what they do is really, I feel, horrific. They take advantage of patients and their families. There's no questions that they troll the hallways. I've had patients where these hospice people have come up to them in church, in their churches or their public places, and make comments to them about whether they need hospice. The other thing is they do is they, as a physician, they attempt to get their own physicians involved because they know that their own physicians will order less expensive drugs, especially the pain medications. If you put a patient on a for-profit hospice, they tend to take them off some of the more expensive pain medications and put them on the cheaper pain medications because their profit margins are so much greater. I think the for-profit hospice situation in this country is really horrendous, and I think patients need to understand that the care they get will be very different depending upon the organization that they decide to go with. And I'm very glad that you all are bringing this up to the public.
Robert, you're a medical professional. What difference does it make if it's a less expensive painkiller? Maybe that's a good thing. We spend a lot, but or does it make a difference for the dying?
It does make a difference because a lot of these times these patients have been on the more expensive medication for weeks or for months, and their pain is under excellent control. They go to hospice, and all of a sudden, they then start switching their pain medications, and it can be weeks or days or weeks before their pain gets under control, and it's all done for profit. And because some of the pain is a major issue, at least in oncology, that most patients end up going into palliative care, and pain medication is very individualized. And it can take days or weeks before you get the most appropriate pain situation. And also, as your previous caller called, sometimes it then becomes up to the patient's family to give the pain medication, because a lot of the cheaper pain medications are given as an injection as opposed to the more expensive ones, which may be given either orally or as a patch. And so what you're basically doing is you're asking the families to become more involved with actually administering the medication. And they're not, a lot of the times, they're not even prepared, trained, or equipped to do so. And again, it's one thing if you're doing it to maximize pain control. That's another thing if you're doing it to maximize the profit of the organization. And I've seen it happen too frequently.
Yeah, Robert, I'm really grateful to you as a medical professional chiming in here. Thanks for calling from Appleton, Wisconsin there. Ben Hallman in San Francisco, stand by. I want to go to New York and J. Donald Schumacher. He's president and CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. They represent both nonprofit and for-profit hospice companies or operations. J. Donald Schumacher. Don Schumacher, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Your industry, if that's the right word for it, and I guess it is reading this, is taking some pretty tough lumps here in the Washington Post and the Huffington Post. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this characterization as for-profit hospice groups as kind of off the hook here in pursuing revenue and profits from the dying? That's the image that we're getting from the reporting that we're reading, Don.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, the hospice community grew out of a grassroots movement back in the 1970s, early 70s, and I was there at the time. And as such, almost all of the hospice providers back then were not for profit. But since that time, and this has happened in every other area of healthcare in this country, the for-profit sector has entered the field today and comprises actually more than half of the hospice community. And you look at Medicare, there are no distinctions in regulations or policies between for-profit and not-for-profit. The same quality measures and payments and regulations apply equally to both of them. So I get concerned when certainly – and I do get this, frankly, across my desk quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I get concerned when there are patient and family complaints about the quality of the care that's being provided. That's the largest issue in my book. We are a part of the American healthcare system, and as being such, there is room in that system for both for-profit and not-for-profit providers, as every other provider group has. But the issue for me always comes back to quality and how we manage quality. And I will tell you, and I think Ben actually mentioned it earlier and has covered it, you can get a hospice license in this country right now in some states and not be surveyed for anywhere up to 11 to 20 years. I know one program in California recently contacted me. They had not had a survey in 20 years. So no matter what is going on in that hospice program, be it for-profit or not-for-profit, if somebody isn't looking at what it is that you're doing, I think there's greater opportunity for many things to go wrong.
So Ben's writing about this in Georgia, low bar for entry into business, hundreds of hospices in Atlanta alone.
Absolutely. And if you don't have somebody looking at what it is that you're doing, the government, I think that the opportunity for things to go wrong is actually quite substantial and greater. So we have actually sponsored legislation now where hospices would be surveyed, as Ben identified with nursing homes. Hospices would receive surveys at a minimum of every 3 years in an attempt to try and cut down some of what might be described as difficulties in providing care services.
I'm looking at a published study out of JAMA Internal Medicine.
Yes.
Saying that for-profit hospices have significantly higher disenrollment rates than nonprofits. That seems – I mean, we thought this was a one-way ticket. Years ago, we talked with Art Buchwald, who went into hospice and came back up, but we saw that as
yeah,
a great
did.
Rarity. Why would people go into for-profit hospices and come out again? What's that – why would that rate be higher, Don?
Well, actually, that it may be a little bit higher in the for-profit community, but it also happens a great deal in the not-for-profit community, and that's because we are no longer 100% cancer patients. When I started in this business back in the early 1980s, we were all about cancer patients providing services. I've run two hospice programs across the years. And what we did was we transitioned as more and more patients needed our care who are not dying of cancer, patients with dementia in nursing homes, living in nursing homes, or some of the Alzheimer's patients. We did see a major transition in terms of the care that we are providing. It's very difficult to prognosticate a 6 month or less criteria of someone, let's just say, who's dying of Alzheimer's disease than they are of cancer, because that disease waxes and wanes over a period of time. So sometimes these live discharges are a direct result of the fact of two things. One, in some situations, the patient has actually gotten better and no longer qualifies for hospice because they're not dying. And two, some of these patients are dying of an illness that sort of goes up and down in the trajectory. And at a certain point in time, it's determined that even though they will die at some point in time, this may not be the time for them to be in hospice.
Ben Hallman, you suggest that there's some gaming of the system that can go on here. Medicare only pays for so many days. When a for-profit hospice reaches that point, your suggestion is that patient's more likely to be bounced.
Right. Well, so Medicare says that at each hospice, your average length of stay should be less than 6 months. And that's a recognition that, you know, certainly you're going to have patients who are on hospice and deserve to be on hospice, but they might live for 8 months or 9 months or even a year. So the solution was to say, okay, so we'll have the average be less than 6 months. So what I found in my reporting and what some nurses and marketers said to me was that they were told to go find what were called colloquially last gasp patients, people who might be basically on death's door. And enroll them in a sense to sort of change that calculation. So you have a patient who dies within a couple of days to make it so that the patient that lives a lot longer, the average works out for you.
Wow. Don Shoemaker, how do we provide this service, which can be so beautiful? Lots of testimony here from our listeners saying it was essential to family.
Sure.
But get it right. And get it right in terms of business practice with the U.S. government and Medicare, which, after all, it's gone from $3 billion to $15 billion in a very short time being paid out here.
Yeah, and Tom, I want to say this to you. I would say thank goodness, because those patients that did finally receive hospice services were probably languishing or perhaps dying in hospital settings of some very difficult illnesses for a long period of time. In addition to being a hospice provider myself, I've had many family members that go through hospice. And the opportunity to choose to be with your family at this critical time is something that really isn't afforded in many situations other than the hospice movement. Go back to something that Ben said as well. It's not Medicare that says 6 months or less. It's federal legislation. legislation that came out in 1982. And the actual language says 6 months or less if the disease follows its usual course. So in some cases, patients live beyond that. And when they do, hospices continue to take care of those patients.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hospice care in America, now often for profit, big business, and some say bad business for the dying and for taxpayers. Our listeners are sending us all kinds of testimony, and we're reading it. We respect it, of hospice care that was truly merciful for them and members of their family in easing the way to death. But we've got tough stories here as well, reported at some length by Ben Hallman for the Huffington Post, investigative reporter there. His big piece, How Dying Became a Multi-Billion Dollar Industry. J. Donald Schumacher is with us as well. He's president and CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, representing both nonprofit and for-profit hospices. Different categories, those two. We're going to talk about how to choose a hospice before we wrap up here. 800-423-TALK. Don Schumacher, Ben Hallman, please stand by. With us right now from Aspen, Colorado, is Dr. Diane Meyer, professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care, principal investigator of a National Cancer Institute-funded study on palliative care services for cancer patients. Dr. Diane Meyer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's hard for average people to know how to take this on board. We know that it's difficult at the end, and we count, when we turn to a hospice, we count on that hospice to help the dying member of our family, to help the whole family get through it. So it's very disturbing to hear about profit-seeking and manipulation that may be going on in the for-profit sector. How do we think about the ideal and the reality out there today, Dr. Meyer?
Well, I just want to point out, as others have said, that the for-profit system has penetrated the U.S. healthcare system in virtually every setting. We have for-profit hospitals. We have for-profit cancer centers. We have for-profit dialysis units. We have for-profit home care agencies. We have for-profit nursing homes. So hospice is by no means unique, and in fact, our nation as a whole is moving in the direction of having taxpayer dollars support for-profit healthcare.
But
industries.
We only – I mean, all that is true and all that worthy of close examination, but we only die once and we want to get it right.
Yeah, absolutely. So while the problems pointed out in the article that Ben wrote are very concerning and very serious allegations that do need to be addressed – the point that perhaps wasn't made as strongly is the overwhelmingly high satisfaction rates that the American public have with hospice. And this is not just the people calling into your show. This is multiple scientific studies comparing the experience of patients and families who came near the end of their life in hospice, in nursing homes, in hospitals. And there's, you know, 3 to 4 times higher levels of satisfaction from patients and families who received hospice care than care in any of those other settings. Are there bad apples and bad practices in every part of the healthcare industry? There are. So it's very important for the consumer to be informed. And as one of my colleagues said, if you've seen one hospice, you've seen one hospice. So consumers really need to have a set of questions in their head before they decide which hospice to use, and consumers need to know that they do have a choice by law. They don't have to go with the first hospice that comes into their room and offers services. They should find out online and in other ways about what else is available in their community and ask questions.
Is not-for-profit the better choice on its face? Is it that simple?
I don't think it is that simple, unfortunately. I've taken care of hundreds, probably thousands of patients over my many years as a clinician, and I have had great experiences in not-for-profit hospices with my patients and families and some very bad experiences, and the same is true in the for-profit sector. So I have learned to distinguish hospices not based on their profit status, but based on their leadership, based on their responsiveness 24/7. How quickly will a nurse get out if there's a crisis at 3 o'clock in the morning? How quickly will a phone call be returned? How likely is the hospice to employ an adequate number of physicians to work with the rest of the team in taking care of patients? Remember, people on hospice are the sickest, most complex patients in the entire healthcare system. You can't expect nurses to do this alone. Some hospices invest a lot in adequate physician participation in hospice. Others do not. Those are the types of issues that I would inquire about before choosing a hospice for a loved one.
Nurses alone or families alone. One of our first callers described her family being asked to do a lot of the care. Leanna is calling from Buffalo, New York. Leanna, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What's your story?
So my mother was a hospice nurse for about 10 years, mm-hmm. and this was in California, and she worked for a not-for-profit hospice. And there were times where she would have to go out at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. Sometimes she would be the only nurse on call, and sometimes she'd have to go into situations that were dangerous, not only on the outside, because she was mugged at one point, but also into situations that were volatile because of the circumstances.
Sure, all the emotion, and I'm sure it's not easy work, and I've seen people do it incredibly well, so, you know, kudos for that work.
Well, my thing, too, is that I think this is wonderful that we're finally paying attention to hospice care, especially because she was forced out due to the bureaucracy, and I believe the company was switching over to a for-profit platform. But the thing is that sort of irritates me is after watching my mother go through what she did is that there's a constant talk about we need to improve quality of care, and it all sounds really nice and pretty on paper, but the burden of quality of care falls on the nurses. And there should really be an emphasis on not only improving patient quality of care as well as the families, but also the nurses as well. Because if you have an exhausted workforce, no matter how many pretty promises you make, you're not going to improve anything to begin with. And seeing my mother go through what she did, it definitely turned me off to the nursing field. I will admit that.
Leanna, I appreciate your witness on that. Your mom in California making that transition. Let me get one more if I can. Thanks for that call from Buffalo. Marilyn in Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Yes, I had the experience in the early 80s, actually volunteer. I'm a clinical social worker, mm-hmm. but I volunteered at a hospice that was forming in our community, mm-hmm. and it was totally supported. We certainly had our professional staff, but there were all kinds of volunteer support, both for the patients and their family, and volunteers were given support as a group. There was music therapy. There was animal. In some cases, patients responded to animals that were brought in. Mm-hmm. Then, later on, about 3 or 4 years ago, had the experience of visiting a friend who was in a nursing home and being serviced by the nursing home's hospice program.
Okay.
And that was a totally different, stark, bare program. I didn't see anything that was comforting to the patient.
Was it nonprofit or for-profit, Marilyn? Do you know?
Well, the nursing home was for-profit. Our local hospice was a community-supported organization that was nonprofit, and it's still going. It's expanded tremendously.
Marilyn, I appreciate your call as well. Ben Hallman, what about this distinction between profit and nonprofit? Dr. Meyer, says it's not as simple as that, but your reporting sort of describes that as a bright dividing line, Ben.
Well, it's true. It's not as simple in every instance. And in fact, one of the fraud lawsuits that I report on in the story involves a not-for-profit in Central Florida, where the executives at the hospice had bonus targets and were rewarded based on the number of people they enrolled, and as a result, were enrolling huge numbers of people who didn't belong. So, from a fraud standpoint, it's not unique to the for-profit sector. Just in terms of care, I mean, I think one of the things we're struggling with, and I certainly struggled with as I reported my story, is what to make of anecdotal experiences. Certainly, there's a huge number of people who had a wonderful experience with a loved one, and I found instances where people had a very bad one, and so that's why I paid a special attention to some of the charges alleged in these in some of these federal cases, especially the case against Vitas, in which the prosecutors alleged that Vitas, in some instances, was billing higher rates to Medicare to treat problems that it had caused. So, for example, administering morphine to a patient who didn't need it, which then caused a toxic reaction and then led to this elevated care, at this $800 or $900 a day level.
And, of course, again, it's sort of startling to think of this Vitas owned by the same parent company that owns Roto-Rooter. Dr. Meyer in Colorado, give us, a quick sketch of how families might best select the best hospice care for a loved one when and if that becomes necessary. How should people approach this?
It's a really good and important question. And I'd say the first thing is to figure out what the options are in your community and find out about their size. So in general, a hospice that is serving fewer than 50 to 100 people per day does not have the economy of scale and infrastructure to really meet the 24/7 needs of these very sick, complex patients. So I do look at size.
So you're saying bigger is better, though
bigger,
one wonders.
Bigger can be better. Mm-hmm. Can be better. Uh-huh. I ask them about the engagement of physicians. Do they actually have physicians that go out to the house if the nurse and the patient and family think it would be helpful? One of the not-for-profit hospices in New York City sends a physician to the home of every patient on hospice, and that physician is part of the team and is actually not just signing forms but really knows the patient and the family and is very actively involved side by side with the nurse in the care of the patient. I think that's a critical element of quality. Some not-for-profit hospices don't do that. I wouldn't go with that kind of not-for-profit hospice. Some for-profit hospices do that. So it's really more about how do they take care of these very complex sick patients? What are their policies for availability, responsiveness, access to physicians?
Is there any rating system? Can you go on Yelp and see people reviewing hospice care? I don't know how. I mean, surely there's a culture at each hospice center as well.
Yes, there is. And it is let the buyer beware. This is true of doctors, true of hospitals, true of hospices. My main advice to patients and families is if you feel your needs are not being met and people are not responsive appropriately, you need to change. You need to not accept that. You need to demand better, and there are multiple hospices in most communities, and you can switch.
Of course, it's the last thing people want to be doing is shuttling around at that point in an emotionally and physically exhausting moment of transition in life.
Of course, but I do think that people need to learn to trust their judgment. If their judgment is that things aren't good and they're not getting their needs met, don't think that you're crazy. You know, trust yourself and advocate for what your loved one needs.
Dr. Diane Meyer, professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital, with us today from Aspen, Colorado. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me go to Grove, Oklahoma, and Wayne. Wayne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I actually am a hospice worker, a marketer, and I've been a marketer for almost 15 years in hospice. But I kind of resent sometimes being called a troll because I've seen both sides of it. My mom passed away last year, mm-hmm. and she actually had the best care through hospice. And, you know, a lot of these people are not talking. They're just talking about the nursing part, but they don't talk about the aftercare that they get from the bereavement. They don't talk about, you know, we have three shifts. You know, there's a lot of factors in that that we really appreciate. You know, I mean, we have three different teams. We have a day team, a night team, and a weekend team. So we have really good, you know, we can admit 24/7. And, you know, so there's a lot of that's not getting out there.
And you're a marketer, so I assume it's a for-profit operation, Wayne.
It is. It's a for-profit.
Would you send your mother to your own hospice care?
My mother was on my hospice care. And it wasn't even with my – we have 15 different excel different areas, mm-hmm. and in the country. And she was not even on my particular hospice, but she was in my hospice group.
Wayne, I appreciate your call. Our time grows short, but there's the attestation that people are out there trying to do it right. Don Schumacher, what percentage these days of hospice care is in a hospice center, and what percentage is care at home, hospice care at home?
Over 90% of all hospice care is provided at home. That home includes the patient's home, or if they're residing in a nursing home, that is considered their home as well. So hospices go in and provide the same services to patients who are residing in their own home or who are living in a nursing home. If the patient needs an acute admission because they have pain or symptom problems that are problematic, many of the hospices have their own hospice facilities that they can admit them into. But under federal law, each hospice has to have a contract with a hospital to provide general inpatient care should the patient be receiving any kind of difficult symptoms that need to be managed somewhere other than a home setting.
What's your best advice? First to the government on how best to assure good hospice care, and second to families when it comes time to choose.
When you're choosing, if you're a family member, I think Dr. Meyer's points were absolutely excellent. The other piece that I would ask for is ask them when they were surveyed last by a hospice program or by the state association looking at your hospice provision, and making sure that you ask as many questions as you possibly can. One of the things that I think is most important is that people don't wait too long to have these conversations. I look forward to a story that Ben could possibly do on the importance of having these conversations earlier so that people are making these choices much sooner in the disease process and not waiting till the last couple of days of their lives. I think our statistic right now is one-third of our patients come in and die within hospice in 7 days, two-thirds within 30 days. And those patients oftentimes have been living in difficult circumstances, experiencing pain. And after the death of a patient who's only been with you for a very short period of time, the family often feels they wish they had entered hospice sooner.
J. Donald Schumacher, President and CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, joining us today from New York, representing both profit, for-profit, and non-profit hospice centers. Don Schumacher, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Ben Hallman, your family, yourself, you look down the road, going to use hospice if it comes to that?
Well, you know, I think the importance of having that conversation earlier is key. Death is something we don't want to talk about. And I think that if there's one takeaway, if you're getting close to the scenario where you think you might need hospice, it's better to start thinking about it sooner. On our website, we have a tool where you can search hospices and get at least some data about the last time they were surveyed, and see also some information about violations that were reported during those surveys.
Ben Hallman, investigative reporter for The Huffington Post. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.